This podcast is made possible by our generous sponsor, Flatiron Cafe and Center City Liquor at 561 State Street, Rochester, New York.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the second installation of the Little Italy Association of Rochester podcast. I am Zach Opsitnik, joining you once again.
Hi, I'm Rob Schwartz. I'm glad to be back to this. And next to me is the Grand Poobah, the Fest Silvano Orsi.
Hello, everyone.
And joining us in studio as our special guest, we have current Rochester City Council member and also current Rochester Congressperson candidate, Mr. Adam McFadden.
How you doing, Rochester? Glad to be here.
And Mr. McFadden is going to be running for, is currently running for Congress in the 25th District. Just for those who may not know exactly where said district is, could you let us know and who, you know, who would be eligible to vote for you?
Oh, I put it this way. Start with the city of Rochester and work your way out to the surrounding suburbs, and that's pretty much the district.
Well said. So one thing I want to ask you is, give some background about yourself and what you're doing now for the people out there who don't enter your district or anything.
Well, professionally, I started my career here in Rochester as a financial analyst at Fleet Investment Operations. After that, I became a controller of a software development company. And then I went on to run a not-for-profit called Quad A for Kids, where we serve about 1,000 kids 5 days a week, 3 hours a day during the school year. I'm the longest sitting member of the Rochester City Council. I'm the vice president currently. I've been on the city council 15 years, and I passed and wrote a bunch of legislation, most recently the source of income discrimination legislation against landlords discriminating against renters for where their income comes from.
Very good. One thing, if I can't vote for you because I'm not in your district somehow, but I don't have really a party affiliation. I'm sure they're all good people running. Why do you stand out? Why should I vote for you?
I have a real reputation as a real fighter. There are a lot of folks using that term real loosely. But if you're fighting and haven't gotten any results, then you're a ham and egger to me and not a fighter. So for me, I'm a real fighter with real results. And most importantly, I put people before I put, my leadership. So
I know your record's good like that because I've always hear people who have been involved in politics 20-odd years. Well, this time we're going to do this. And if you were something else, you'd be gone if you did like any of our business. Now, one thing was I used to work in D.C. a long time ago. I'm pretty old, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So and back in the day, I would go to lunch, like a walk down by the Botanical Gardens. This was when the abortion battles were going on, and you'd see like nastiness all galore, but I was involved in politics in college, and the opposing side and I got along great. Now it's become very nasty. Now you have a very thick skin. Why do this? I mean, you're obviously committed to this.
You know, I grew up in extreme poverty in a middle class neighborhood, so we were known as the poor family. So everyone let us know we were poor, and so when you grow up in a situation where everyone constantly picked on you, there's nothing much that anybody else can do to you because you've experienced every name in the book, every hardship, every, you know, negative thing. So as an adult now, that just rolls off my back, and I give it back pretty good, too.
Yeah, that's, you have to, really. Yeah. You can't, not otherwise. It's just not good.
Well, and to kind of piggyback on that, you know, in this day and age in politics where everything is so contrarian, you know, we were talking before we sat down here, you know, you could say something so mundane and so acceptable. The sky is blue. No, it's not. Or, you know, the one that sadly has been going around a lot. The earth is round. Well, no, it isn't. So coming into an election like this where you're obviously going to be dealing with that, what's your thought process? How do you come into it knowing that you might have to face some absurdities such as that?
Let's try to represent truth. And, make sure that I'm speaking not just on behalf of my views and values, but on behalf of the people who tend to want change and want what I would call sensible relationships between elected officials. For me, I've fought more Democrats than I have Republicans, and I'm a Democrat. But at the end of the day, when you have to make decisions or try to get legislation passed, you have to work with people. So I try to deal with everybody on an individual basis, no matter how I may personally feel about them. If it's about solving a problem, I tend to put that to the side and try to just focus on the issue.
Now, poverty, I studied a lot about poverty in college, so I'm useless because I'm not in the arena like you. So what would you say would be some of the practical steps in the real world that we can elevate some of these situations? Because people need a hand up.
Well, I would say, first of all, we have to start with young folks and emphasize the importance of education as a pathway out of poverty. We've gotten too academic with poverty, talking about silos and systems. It all boils down to education. Everyone knows if you graduate from high school, you have a better chance of succeeding in life. If you graduate from college, it gets even better. You go to grad school, it gets even better. So we have to push the fact that education is the way out of poverty. Right now, we're trying to, you know, provide mentors and throw money at not-for-profits. And that's not to say that there's not a place for that. But if you don't have a foundation that said education is the way, none of that stuff will work.
One thing Lyndon Johnson said is, like, if you free somebody, what's good about it if they're still shackled? If somebody's born in poverty, they need some help. I mean, it's hard. You're coming home to a bad situation. Are there ways to, like, some offer some kind of job opportunities? Just say, like, you know, intro level to help people get skills?
I think we've gotten to the point where even people who have education are underemployed. So it's hard to say a job is the answer when you have people who have diplomas or degrees that are still, you know, trying to make ends meet. So we have to push education to put everybody on a higher plane to try to figure out what our job market is going to be, you know, 20 years from now. We relied on manufacturing so long here in Rochester that we didn't really look at anything else. And then when manufacturing went away and now we have automation, we're scratching our heads. We're so far behind now because we didn't think ahead.
That's the thing. Back in the day for college, I could afford it with a part-time job. Now I see, like, my alma mater is ridiculous. So are there means to help people who don't have the means to be able to get an education?
Well, I think we have to come to terms that community college should be free. Public institutions like the SUNY system should be free for everybody. That's where we have to go.
Yeah, so not just, because I know, didn't they pass recently the public institutions such as the SUNYs were free to New York residents?
New York residents at a certain income level.
At a certain income level.
Yes. Okay. But so if you were doing better than everyone else, then you probably had to pay.
Right.
One thing important to us, obviously, is the Little Italy neighborhood and everything. And I've heard you have some Italian heritage in you.
Oh, yeah. My father, his name was Salvatore, passed away a few years ago. My grandmother was born in Pinataro Maggiore. She was a war bride. So my grandfather in World War II, his job in Capua was to drive women over to this ammunition plant because we blew up a bridge that gave them access to it. So he had to drive them every day. I'm sure he's hitting on every Italian woman every day. And my grandmother just happened to give him the time of day. And so they ended up being married in Pinataro. And my father was born, and then they moved here. And then my uncle was born. And then they actually, my grandmother developed MS. She lived here for a while and then moved back to Italy with my father and my uncle because they thought it was the air here that was causing her illness. So they went back there, and she didn't get any better, so then she came back to Rochester.
Well, the Little Italy Project, obviously close to our hearts. Now, what does it mean for you in the neighborhood, and what would you, if you were elected, and you will be elected, hopefully, what would you try to do for the neighborhood there, for the project?
Well, I think celebrating, you know, Italian heritage and everyone else's heritage is important because it is a part of our history. Rochester just didn't come on the map, and it just had some bland people that were born here. There are a lot of people that immigrated or migrated to our city. And I think, you know, it's on us to kind of connect those roots because we're so far away from it now that most of us don't celebrate how we got here.
Well, that's what it, and I think the more generations that go by, we tend to
lose a little more.
Yeah, I think we tend to lose a little more, like, you know, but there are some cultures that tend to be a lot more in tune with their roots. And I think that, you know, these neighborhood organizations like the Little Italy neighborhood is really going to be a huge boom because regardless of where you came from, where your family came from originally, I think you should be in touch with it, to know about it, and, you know, to have the sense of pride in wondering, why did my people come here?
Oh, absolutely. And I think even in African-American culture, My mother, her family, they migrated from South Carolina. They were sharecroppers. And the reason why they came here is because I had a couple of uncles that got a job at Rochester Products in manufacturing, and they said, hey, this is better than being in the fields. Everybody come up. And so half the family moved up to Rochester searching for jobs in manufacturing because they were tired of working in the fields.
And I was going to say, with the Italian part of the family, do you know happen to know why they came, settled in Rochester?
Yeah, so my grandmother, when my grandfather and her first came to America, and she got cleared through the WIFE program at Ellis Island. Is it Ellis? What is the one in New York? I always get it confused.
I think it's Ellis.
Yeah, I think they still call it Ellis Island.
And they actually moved to Philadelphia to a black neighborhood. Mm. And my grandmother was shell-shocked with that. And she had two sisters that were already here in Rochester.
Okay.
And so she said, there's no way I'm going to stay here. I want to go to where my sisters are. And so that's how they ended up in Rochester. So Italy at the time, a lot of folks don't know this, Italy at the time after the war was a very poor country, had a lot of issues. So my grandparents would send things back like penicillin, toys, clothes, all those things. So even when I went over to Italy, I had people coming up to me telling me all these great, wonderful stories about my grandparents and what they did for their family and how they sent money and medicine and all of this stuff. And, just to see that, I actually got to see like a table and chair that my grandfather made for some school children who didn't have any place to sit. And he made that with his hands.
And still there
to this
day.
Yes.
We heard like the story of Bruno Sammartino, the wrestler who just passed, but when he was a kid in Italy, he had to go live in a cave.
Yes.
Because of the
Nazi occupation.
Yeah. But one thing with the Little Italy Fest is, I mean, we're trying to be inclusive to all cultures as we celebrate your culture. Being this, what would you do, or what are you doing for the designation of the Little Italy district as a historical?
Well, I'm part of the planning committee, and I'm going to be working with Molly Clifford, who's the council member of that district, to make sure that Little Italy gets the proper designation, to make sure we get funding for Charette. That is important for the success of this project, and we're not going to let it go.
I mean, that's good because, I mean, people say money's not important. Money's important.
Money is very
without
important.
It's like, oh, I'm going to do this
in
by just
waiting. In a capitalistic society, money is everything.
Yeah.
Let's be honest about what it is.
Hopes and dreams. Is one thing.
People say you don't need money for development. You need money. That's how you have to get everything developed.
Just to have a plan costs money.
And how do we draw people in? Because there's unfortunately, and this still goes with friends of mine, I think it's terrible because I've always frequented the city. They have that paranoia about neighborhoods. And how do you bring them in?
I put it this way. That paranoia that they see is perpetuated by unfair broadcasting of negative things. And what I mean by that is people tend to think that people who live in poverty aren't happy folks or that they're not good people, and that's just not true. Poverty does not have anything to do with, being unhappy or being dangerous or anything like that. A lot of us come from what I would call poverty-stricken roots, and our families still had values. And so I think right now we just have to tell a different story about what some of these neighborhoods are, but not just that. Most of the times when you see these things that happen, they're happening to people in a certain lifestyle. I live in a what I would call a middle class neighborhood that has its string of issues. But I can tell you this, I'm not a part of that. So it doesn't impact me in a direct sense. It does from a community sense. But I'm not worrying about me getting killed in a drug deal. Why? Because I'm not in a drug deal. So I just kind of look at it that way. And these things happen all over the place. Bad people don't see imaginary lines. If they're going to kill you, they're not thinking about, am I in the city or am I in Greece right now?
And I know that because I live in a suburban area. We've had cars get boosted. But you never hear about that on the news.
It's the way that it's perpetuated in media. And I'm not just blaming media, but I blame us for being a sucker to the media, in a sense that, whatever is sold to us, we buy. And you know, that's the most dangerous thing about it.
I'd like to say it, but I still think it's still that latent racism too.
Oh yeah,
that's just that people exists. Still. It's there. It's just under the surface now, unfortunately.
Well, and you know, we had a forum Friday night, and it was about racism. It was about environmental justice and economic justice. And I just said to the crowd, who was predominantly white, a lot of them were from the suburbs, if this is the issue that you care about, be ready for these folks to live next door to you. If you're not ready for them to live next door to you, then you don't really care about the issue. Because you can't fix this from 5,000 feet away. You have to be directly impacted by it.
So I say, I welcome anyone in my neighborhood as long as you're not a jerk.
Yeah.
That's the way I am. We have a good melting pot, and they're all very nice folks.
The places I've lived, I've always had the – I find that older people make the best neighbors because they make the – You know, they watch out for your property. They look out the window.
You never had the guy telling you, get off my lawn.
You know, I kind of love the fact that I have very active neighbors that'll say, hey, you know, there's somebody on your porch, and it could have been somebody dropping off a package. But, I like that vigilant, you know, watchdog.
I have a funny story for you like that. I used to have a blue car, so I'm taking my dog for a walk. Police officer pulls me over. Mm. Like, oh, is he going to shoot my dog? But what happened was, it turned out the neighbor next door saw a suspicious vehicle and they would call the police. It was blue. It was a guy delivering phone books. But, you know, in a way, that's nice. It's like they're looking out. But
yeah. Well, you know, I just think that sometimes we have gotten to a place where people want to close their blinds or close their shades and not, you know, look at anything. But I think that's what makes a neighborhood, that you look out for each other. My neighbor now, he has a key to my house, have a key to his house. We trust each other. And he lets me know when he's going on vacation. So if I got to pull his garbage cans out or pull them back in, or vice versa. And that's right in the city. I have no problems with him having a key to my house. I trust that he's not going to go in and do, you know, crazy things or whatever. But that's just being neighborly, you know?
Hey, we don't live in a vacuum.
Right.
We have to try to take people as being people. I mean, we're all good and bad, so.
Well, and that's what I was going to say, because I remember growing up, I grew up in a small town, a small suburb of Pittsburgh, down in Pennsylvania, and it was like that. It was a neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we knew all the neighbors. We could go to the neighbors' houses, pop in, just say hello. We could, you know, sometimes get a sandwich or something. But that sense of community, and it goes back to the old adage, it takes the village.
That's right.
It just seems to be disappearing a lot.
But that's why having a designation like Little Italy is important, to return back to old school neighborhood values, where people looked out for each other. I mean, growing up in poverty, I can tell you, you know, I was sent to people's houses for eggs and sugar and, you know, things like that, because we didn't have it and they didn't mind giving it to us. And they didn't, I would say, pick on us or make a thing out of it. Just, okay, Miss Barbara needs some eggs, here you go. You know, it wasn't a big deal.
I saw the recent thing, the article about there's like the sharing now in some neighbors. Mm-hmm. If you need something or gives, and I think that's a very good idea.
Oh, absolutely.
But one thing is, I grew up on Laser Street. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was a kid, we knew everybody. And now I realize, like almost after 9/11, I didn't know any of my neighbors. And one thing I think is big in neighborhoods are home ownership. So what could you do to increase that, you think?
Well, I think we have to be honest. There are some people who just don't want the responsibility of owning homes. But for those who do, we have a beautiful, what I would call, overage of housing stock in a city, meaning we have more houses than we do, you know, residents. There's no reason why we couldn't wrestle with the banks that own them to try to get them back, fix them up, and get them on the market in an affordable way for folks who do want to own houses.
There's actually one of my professors said that it's about how many houses are abandoned in the city. And I just like agree with you. And I like how you said responsibility. You don't just give some. But if you're willing to take, and you know, and it's not easy. Like, I have to cut my grass sooner.
That's right.
A jungle. But you have to have some responsibility and just go, you know, we'll help you, you help us.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's a part of it. If you've been a renter, I mean, someone comes and cuts your grass. Somebody might come and put salt down. And trust me, there's something to that, too, because there's some people who just don't want to, you know, that kind of responsibility. And I think when I get older, I definitely don't want it. But, you know, for those folks who do want, you know, to build equity and build a portfolio, those are things that help you out of poverty. So when you get that property and you pay it off, and then when you pass, you pass it on to your kid, and then they get it debt free, and then they're able to build a life. I mean, that's really what we're talking about.
And make it really a community. Yeah. Like people, like I've lived here, my family's lived here. We care about it. It's not just brick and mortar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there, I'll put it this way. As I get older, though, I want to get less neighbors. You know, I want to. I'm just saying, I can see me being like an old guy that has a lot of land that can see you coming down my path before you see me.
I've said that myself. I said I'm going to become a country gentleman, live out in Ontario, and my last neighbor 5 miles away from me.
I have an appreciation for that because I get bothered all the time with people's stuff. I accept that as my responsibility. But when I get older, there's going to be a point where I say I'm out of this completely. And I don't want to be bothered.
I know it is. I mean, it is a tough burden because, I mean, you have to care about everything because everybody looks at you as, well, I can't do this. Like, Adam, cut my lawn.
Even in the Square Fair Parade yesterday, I got stopped 3 times on, you know, issues that were in the neighborhood that happened. One lady had her dog attacked by a pit bull. Another lady was complaining about the police not doing a report. And then someone else complained about nothing, to in my mind, that had anything to do with the job I do, but I still have to follow up on it.
There's always that one person that's always just looking for something to complain about. There's always that. It's like I have people next to me blare music on the weekend too early. I'm not going to call the police. That's petty, you know, something. You know, it's like, let live. If it's big, then deal with it. Don't sweat the small stuff.
And for me, you know, all I wanted to do was hand out candy at the parade.
But that's what it is. Regardless of if it's your, under your jurisdiction or not, they still see you as the authority figure that,
deal with it.
Hey, he's got his finger on the pulse of this.
I've learned to push people to the folks, though, that can help them with that. But in the beginning, I used to just take it all on because I just thought that's what I should do. But you can burn out very quickly doing that, too.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Congress, it's a tough thing in D.C. Now, what do you hope to do for our neighborhoods in there?
I think the main thing that I want to do is exhaust every resource. And what I mean by that is we've gotten to the point where we look at Republicans as Democrats as the enemies, or Republicans look at us like we're the enemies, to the point that we don't even eat a meal together. Like, that's just unheard of to me, that you can't sit down and just have a meal and talk about one issue and work that way. And that's what I hope to bring to the table, is to go there and say, hey, I don't know you, so I don't have a reason to make you my enemy, but there's this one issue I want to work on. Let's go, you know, have some dinner and just talk about it.
Used to be more, though. I remember back in the Reagan era, him and Tip O'Neill were opposite in every way, but they would be congenial. They might play golf together. Even if we say, I disagree with you, but you're not evil.
Right.
Where now it's like, no.
And that's the thing that I've always found odd, is that regardless of who wins the election, we're going to have to work together.
Absolutely.
So if you run this horrifying, slanderous campaign against the other person, and let's say you lose, how are you expecting to be able to work with them after you've said such, you know,
bad things about them? I've had fun running this campaign. For me, I've been in this business for so long. I started in 1994. Locally, and I think the first campaign I worked on was in 1992 in Orangeburg, South Carolina. So for me, there's no stress. Like, my whole life is not tied up into whether I win or lose. For me, this is just an opportunity that I hope to, you know, make a case about my experience and why I would be good for this. It's not about slandering Rachel, Joe, or Robin. I actually like them all personally for different reasons. I think we have to have this primary. But for me, it's not personal. I'm not going to walk away hating anybody or saying I can't talk to you. Now, I do laugh at some of their comments, but and what they bring to the table, but not in a disrespectful way, just saying, you got to be kidding me. You know, I know I could win this race kind of thing.
Well, exactly. And like I say, like if it's like that, how are we ever going to work together? And that's the whole point of, you know, electing officials, is that we're able to work together to get stuff accomplished for all of us.
Absolutely, because it's not about me, it's not about them, it's about the people. And the people don't want us fighting. I think people think that they want that, but most people don't care about whether I best you in an argument. What they care about is the issues at the end of the day. So if I curse you out and I bring no resources back to the community, what good have I done?
I still think people want, you know, everything, like, they want to be able to feed their families, you know, find, like, gainful employment that they can live on and everything. And they don't care who does it. And if I hear one person go, I'm not voting for Adam, he didn't throw candy at the parade. I'm done, you know, I'm done with that. It's like, I can't work with that person. You can't go, I hate you, I hate you, you're evil. Oh, we have to work together now.
Yeah, you can't do it.
And in this bombastic community, too, I mean, with the president, who's not like a shrinking violet, I mean, this is sort of...
Well, I kind of look at it this. If you had a kid that was dying from cancer, and there's a Republican congressperson who had the cure for cancer, would I say I hate you, or would I say, hey, man, what is the cure? Let's get it done.
These things would be, I hate you, give me that.
Yeah. I hate you, but give me that because I deserve it.
Yeah. Instead of just saying, hey, you got the cure, how can I work with you to get this out?
Now, is there anything, I'm sure you do lots of interviews, you're on the public scene, is there anything you want people to know about you, you like to talk about, nobody ever asks you?
I think people don't realize how much of a jokester I am. They see this big black guy with I have a very stern face. I don't smile a lot, not because I don't like smiling. It's just that my mouth is actually positioned downward and not upward. And so I think people just think like I'm this big, mean guy. And really, I'm like a big teddy bear. Most people don't know that. So, you know, I get branded as the angry black guy or the bully. And really, I'm probably a prankster more than anything.
Okay, you said you're a jokester. I'm going to put you on the spot. You want to tell a joker a funny story?
That's a good one. I hate to do this to somebody, but I actually have a friend who's in town, and they're dropping their kids off yesterday to their parents for the summer because they live in Florida. And I go over there, and their kids are just bad. These are probably the worst kids I've seen in a long time. And they told their mothers, like, they were going to hit her with a bat. And it's like a six-year-old, and she's using all of this, you know, vulgar language. And I just said, man, these are the kids from Talladega Nights. And I just and everybody's looking at me like I'm strange. Said, go watch the movie. These are these kids.
Oh, my. And I actually have a personal one. Many years ago, I just happened to see you at the public market. And I saw you juggling kids around. I'm going, this guy's not scary.
Yeah. No, I have my daughters with me a lot. And they're, you know, they used to be little. They're big girls. Now my baby is almost 6 feet tall, so, and she's 13. But I've if anybody's ever seen me most places, I either have one of the three girls that I have with me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Adam McFadden. And where do people go if they want to help with their congressional campaign?
The easiest way to reach out to me is McFaddenForCongress.com. That's the website. We have a page that can, you know, sign you up to volunteer. Or, you know, if you want to make a contribution to the campaign.
Okay, good. Thank you. It's been a very pleasure talking to you. Okay. This was brought to you by the Little Italy Festival. Remember, it's at Marina Dodge Stadium on Saturday, June 16th. This is a celebration of the Italian-American community's 150th anniversary. We're going to have lots of live entertainment. We're going to have a soccer match, an international soccer match between Indiana and Toronto. Very good clubs. It's going to be top notch. We're going to have fireworks. There's many wonderful sponsors you should go to, including Zweigels and Wegmans. So please come down. It's going to be the event of the year.